We was in a pickup truck. We was coming down to my father's farm. We turned off a main road up a dirt lane to go to his farm. As we were going up the lane, I looked to the left and I seen this big orange ball in the sky, and it wasn't no more than maybe 100 feet off the ground. We was astonished and stopped and then drove on up the house. And so we looked off the porch and we watched. It was just coming down, slow. It was making some kind of humming noise then. My mother and them was there, and they was a little bit scared. So I says, well, I'll go out and look and see what I can see from down there.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today, a favorite guest is with us. He's back. He was with us back in May of 2020, so he's just recently been on Dreamland, but he blew me away with Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness, and the Bigfoot Phenomenon, Volume 1, Folklore. It is so totally fascinating. And Joshua Cutchin, I have to welcome you back to Dreamland. After Joshua spends the first hour with us, we're going deeper to Maria Sagi, her book, Remote Healing, Non-Local Information Medicine, and the Akashic Field. So this is going to be a very exciting weekend on Dreamland. Let's get going. Joshua, what in the world is happening in our forests?
That's a good question, and the only thing I'm confident in saying definitely is that it doesn't seem to be as simple as a large undiscovered species of primate. That's about as definitive as you'll get an answer out of me, I think.
Okay, well, that's a good place to begin, because if it's not that, what about, haven't there been hairs and things found? Certainly footprints.
Oh, absolutely. I have to sort of qualify this and say that I genuinely do hope that there is a flesh and blood Bigfoot. I mean, that's sort of the irony of writing a book like Where the Footprints End, Volume 1, is that both my co-author Timothy Renner and I would love nothing more than to find, you know, evidence of there being an actual animal that we could catalog and capture. But there's just too much high strangeness that surrounds the creature. As far as sort of these, these physical attributes that are left behind, there are instances of hair left behind, and blood samples, and fecal samples, and of course, the footprints, which are quite honestly some of the best evidence that we have in any of these paranormal topics. I mean, I sometimes joke that ufologists and ghost hunters sort of have Bigfoot envy because the physical evidence is so strong and so impressive. But what I would really encourage people to do is to consider the fact that, A, none of these things have been proven to be conclusively from a physical creature, and B, that we really need to abandon this idea of things being physical or non-physical. I mean, if you look at sort of the earliest methods of hunting ghosts, that was achieved by spreading talcum powder on the floor and waiting for ghost footprints to manifest. Similarly, if you're looking at something like psi phenomena,
I've done the ghost footprints thing.
Oh yeah, so exactly what I'm talking about.
It worked. Let me tell you just briefly, when we were first trying to get photos or video of the visitors, a friend of mine, John Gleidman, a physicist who was very skeptical, said, "Well, why don't you just try putting powder on the floor?" And I did that, and what we got were these little things that looked like that someone had feet were like the tip of a broom handle, maybe little dots, and between them was very clearly the swish marks of a tail.
A tail.
And I thought it has to be a practical joke. This was at the cabin. The cats were not there. Annie was not a practical joker, but that doesn't mean she wasn't capable of playing one from time to time, because she had been pranked by me from time to time in her life. It was dangerous to me. You know, you play a practical joke on someone as smart as Anne, and things are going to happen to you that you do not expect. Let me put it that way. And in any case, we never knew what it was, but it was proof of nothing because, you know, it could have been, I could have done it myself.
Well, you know, I tend to believe that a lot of evidence that we gather around all these different things kind of have that built-in chuckle factor and that sort of, I would almost say, self-negating aspect.
Are you familiar with the wolf that appeared when the scientists were going up to take possession of what was then called the National Institute for Discovery Sciences Ranch, now the Skinwalker Ranch? What happened?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, can you? I think that's connected because. Go ahead.
Oh no, I would say so as well. Just to briefly sort of round the horn on the last thing that we're talking about. The other thing that people need to sort of buy into is the fact that if psi phenomena is real, which I think is the one hill that I will die on. That's an entirely interiorized, non-physical attribute that will have physical effects on the environment around you. So this idea of physical, non-physical, I would rather have it sort of quantified as imaginary, imaginal. But, you know, having said that, the wolf you were referring to, about, you know, what was called the Sherman Ranch or the Gorman Ranch or the Skinwalker Ranch or, you know, the Nids Ranch, was a large wolf. You know, if you were to estimate perhaps something along the lines of what we would call dire wolf size, sort of a wolf the size of a small pony, that was repeatedly shot at with no reactions at all by the ranchers, the family that owned the property at the time, but also at the same time was physical enough to attack one of the calves that they had in one of their corrals. And you're right, because this wolf exhibits, you know, among other things, the attribute of being bulletproof, which Bigfoot really does seem to be bulletproof, whatever it may be. You know, there are a lot of people who will say, oh, Bigfoot's skin is thicker or, you know, Bigfoot has a large layer of subdermal fat. But if you really look at it objectively, sometimes people hit these animals at point-blank range with high-powered rifles and they don't react at all. You know, I don't care if you're shooting at a charging grizzly bear, it's still going to at least react. You might not stop it, but it still might at least react. To say nothing of the fact that primate hair actually tends to be thinner on parts of the body that are covered in hair. So that also sort of diminishes the idea that Bigfoot have really thick skin. So, yeah, the bulletproof aspect is really quite a conundrum. But it does seem something that's in common with a lot of these different animals from these, for lack of a better term, imaginal realms.
Yeah. But maybe not so imaginal, you know, because you're talking to a fairly weird host. I mean, you know that. I mean, I've been actually physically in it. I've been in it.
Oh, absolutely.
Semi-physically on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in the summer of 2019. And I was physically in it twice here in Santa Monica. And I'm telling you, when I was physically in it, I was in another version of this world. Now, it might not have been the same parallel universe that Bigfoot comes out of, but I have a feeling somehow that it was. And there are certain things about it. It's colder. It's much less populated. It's the sun is not as bright. And there are other things about it. I don't want to go into it. My listeners have already heard the stories. But what I do want to do is to ask you this. Do you think that it could be that animals evolve the ability as a kind of defense mechanism, some animals in that universe, to move into ours? In other words, they can cross over.
Oh, I think it's absolutely a possibility. I mean, it's kind of funny. I've had some people, including Patrick Harper, who blurb the back of the book, say, you know, well, Josh, what is yours and Timothy's sort of final argument, your thesis, your conclusion? I said, nothing really besides the fact that Bigfoot is strange. So, I mean, I think that what you end up flirting with when you talk about a lot of these different topics, not just Bigfoot, but, you know, the UFO question, and also I would even venture so far as to say ghosts and haunting, you end up sort of falling into the question of the interdimensionality of these things, and, you know, what is the afterlife, or, you know, the classical other world,
right,
by any other name than another dimension. You know, it's basically we're talking about the same thing as we always have.
Yep.
So I think that's entirely possible. One of the ideas that my co-author proposed was perhaps Bigfoot happened to be more magically fluent than human beings. Somehow having harnessed some of these occult practices that we as human beings know, and we're kind of okay at it, but compared
okay.
to Bigfoot, like,
I want to stop you right there for two reasons. One is, we have to get deeply into this because I think you're right at the edge of something incredibly cool. The other is that my free listeners have got to wait for it. So, free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back.
Jordan Maxwell has been researching the secret world, the hidden world, for nearly 50 years. Here is what he has found.
There is a real war going on in the world between humans that want to be free and a handful of humans who want to own everything.
Find out how this relates to things like the life of Christ and your life and what we need to know and understand about the dark side. This is just one of over 1,000 interviews on the Unknown Country Archive, a literal treasury of wonderful, extraordinary, and unusual material, unlike anything else in the world, and probably a few other worlds thrown in. And plus, it's cheap. It's $4.95 a month, $12.95 for 3 months. Sign up with a credit card, or you can sign up with PayPal. Canceling is easy. You do it right in your own account whenever you feel you want to. But stay with us, because the other side of this coin is there's a lot of social life on unknowncountry.com, and it works very differently from Facebook or Twitter or any of those things, because we don't sell your information. It stays here. When you're going on our social media, you're not followed by algorithms, which will then push ads to you and invade your privacy. We respect your privacy, and the same is true of our free newsletter. We respect your privacy. We do not sell anything to anybody else. And this is why we need you, because without subscribers, we can't go on. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab. We're talking to Joshua Cutchin. His website, joshuacutchin.com, joshuacutchin.com. Simplest way to get there, just go to the Dreamland homepage and read the story about Joshua, and you will find the website. His new book, oh my, is so much fun. And in a time when it's so crappy and screwed up at every level, a book like Where the Footprints End is just a delightful release. High Strangeness in the Bigfoot Phenomenon, Volume 1, Folklore. I love it. Okay, let's go back to where we were. You were just getting rolling, and I know Joshua's how Joshua works in interviews, so I'm just going to let you keep rolling.
Well, that's too kind of you. You know, we were talking about the ability for Bigfoot to sort of, perhaps for lack of a better term, phase in and out of realities, or, you know, somehow have adapted this as an evolutionary adaptation. But the possibility that Bigfoot perhaps is extremely magically proficient. You know, my co-author Timothy Renner has proposed the idea that we sort of, instead of viewing Bigfoot through cryptozoology, perhaps we need to view it through a new field that we deem cryptoanthropology, which would take a look at the possibility that Bigfoot might be doing things, you know, in a ritual capacity. I mean, if you look at sort of the excavations that have happened around Neanderthal sites, it becomes very apparent that even, you know, the sort of offshoots of man, other hominins, were thinking in a ritual or, you know, religio-magical sort of manner.
You're referring to Shanidar Cave, for example?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, you'll find certain things like, you know, they found what they believe is a Neanderthal flute Also, you'll find certain veneration of the dead in some of these areas as well that are really compelling. And if we just thought of Neanderthals as being almost like a very advanced animal, it just doesn't quite line up with that as well. So it's really interesting to sort of think of that in that capacity. These ancestors of ours, for lack of a better, more specific term, we're tending to think symbolically, and that's something that we sort of have only given ourselves credit for the longest time.
Okay, let's move on. Bigfoot, fairies, and aliens trends. I love it when people bring in the fairy lore because it's so important. Jacques Vallée in Passport to Magonia nailed it. He nailed it in the sense that he showed that there was a continuity between what people see and experience in UFO and alien encounters and what they saw and experienced in encounters with the fairy folk for hundreds of years. Okay, you say, even if we reject the abundance of evidence associating Bigfoot, fairies, and aliens with UFOs, the similarities between Bigfoot sightings and the alien fairy contact experience resonate in a variety of ways. You start with the way they smell, then you go on. And let's talk about some of this material. What about the odor?
Yeah, well, I mean, Vallée's work had such an impact on me that I find it really difficult to separate fairies and aliens at all.
I don't think you should.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of started calling them Thalians,
That's great.
But it's interesting. You know, I talked about this a little bit in my second book, The Brimstone Deceit, so I didn't perhaps dedicate as much space in this book as I should have, but there is a similarity of odors that you find across all these different things. Commonly, I would say they're odors of entropy, odors of decay or rot or mustiness. To get a little bit more specific, there are plenty of examples of Bigfoot being reported to smell like hydrogen sulfide, which is a sort of rotten egg odor, which occurs in, I wouldn't say a majority of, abductions or contact experiences, but I would certainly say a plurality of them whenever a smell is noted. And you'll find some curious descriptions of fairies as smelling like, there was actually a Welsh, I believe, pastor who several centuries back described the fairies as smelling similar to a congregation of unwashed lay people. So, which the author of this particular interpretation back several centuries ago further compared that to the expulsion of subterranean gases, which would include things like hydrogen sulfide. So whenever you're dealing with smell, you kind of have to unpack what people mean, because we're really poor in terms of describing smell as human beings, as English speakers.
Now, telepathy appears in abductions. I've experienced it. I've experienced a couple different kinds of it. The fairy folk, the smells. I had a weird thing happen about 2 weeks ago. Someone showed up here physically. And I'm always kind of restrained. It's not exactly restrained, but I couldn't get this person to come near me, but they smelled so good. It wasn't perfume. It was a human smell, like a smell of a person who doesn't bathe like we bathe, but still smelled beautiful. It was amazing. I've never smelled anything like it. And I wanted them to stay. And, of course, they immediately then left, as is always happens in my case.
Mm-hmm.
So what about smells in this? I've even looked into the research and literature about temporal lobe epilepsy and people smelling unusual odors while in seizure. But I don't think this is connected. People smell these smells like when they're out in the woods walking.
Right. Yeah. So It's really interesting. In my work, I've at least discovered the fact that smells hedonically, in terms of sort of the quality, the positive or negative quality of them, hedonically they tend to correspond to positive or negative experiences, which means, in other words, very rarely do you get a positive experience with, you know, an entity of any kind that smells bad, or a negative experience that smells good. So that at least completely tracks, as far as, you know, a scientific explanation for these things. The waters are a little bit muddied, in particular by ghost hunters, because there are some very specific smell disabilities that people can get. Interestingly enough, you know, this is sort of something that I've found fascinating about the whole COVID thing, people's ability or inability to smell.
But, yes.
You know, you have like anosmia, which is the inability to smell. There are also conditions where you smell something completely differently than you do. I actually have a friend who had COVID who now can smell, but she smells things that smell pleasant, smell disgusting to her. But you'll find a lot of ghost hunters who have started throwing around the term phantosmia, which is a legitimate neurological term for odor, and it means that you smell smells that aren't there. But when ghost hunters throw it around, they mean, oh, that's the smell of a ghost. But you have to be really specific when you use that, because only one person has phantosmia. They'll smell something that no one else in a group will smell. By contrast, a lot of these experiences that people have, if there are other witnesses, the witnesses might actually agree on smell, which means that it's not, you know, a neurological condition in one of the witnesses. So you had to be really, really careful when you look into this sort of thing.
Okay, well, this is getting extremely exciting. We're going to learn a little bit more today than we usually do, because mostly when you talk to Bigfoot, people involved in Bigfoot, they're on kind of one side or the other. They believe it's strictly a physical phenomenon, or that it is a paranormal phenomenon. Josh is different. He's walking that tightrope beautifully. Now, free Dreamlanders, don't walk a tightrope right now. Instead, listen up, for you must remember this.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting, and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks.
We're talking to Joshua Cutchin. His new book, Where the Footprints End, a treasure trove of fascinating, fun, mind-bending, and mind-opening material about Bigfoot, E.T., fairy folk, and so much more. You can have more Joshua Cutchin Fun on his website, joshuacutchin.com, where you can also meet his really cool co-author, Timothy Renner, who works with him. How do you work together, you two guys?
You know, it's interesting. I'd never really co-authored a book with anyone, and I think we sort of took a bit of inspiration from The Supernatural, which you did with Jeffrey Kripal. Because what we ended up doing is, you know, we weren't sure as opposed to, you know, whether or not we were supposed to try to write chapters together or something along those lines. So what we really ended up doing was alternating chapters. So we each took a subject, and then we would pass the chapters between each other and say, oh, this is great. Have you considered this or that or the other? And then we'd follow up on it. So, you know, each chapter has its own byline, but there's a little bit of us in every chapter of the book.
So that's how it works. It sounds like you've been very comfortable with each other, because I've had three co-authors and I've always enjoyed working with them, but I hear stories that, you know, people, you could do a sitcom about co-authors trying to kill each other, I suspect.
Timothy and I get along very well. I think Timothy put it best on an interview that we had together just a couple of weeks back, where he said, you know, I love Josh. I would raise Josh's kids. I'm not sure if we'd do another two-volume book series together.
I hear that.
Yeah, I think it's part of the process. But honestly, I couldn't have done it with anybody besides him. He really fills a gap in my research where he does a lot more field work than I do and has actually had a lot of really fascinating encounters himself. He does a great job of taking a look at some aspects that I wouldn't have necessarily considered. And also, you know, it was nice for me to not want to address something and to throw it his way. So volume one talks entirely about our chapter on aliens focuses on the, you know, what, for lack of a better term, is the alien contact experience, the abduction experience. But volume two is about UFOs seen outside of craft. So volume one has a chapter on Bigfoot inside of craft. And volume two has a chapter on Bigfoot outside of craft. And I said, you know, Tim, you're going to take Bigfoot outside of UFOs because it's just too broad of a subject. And believe it or not, he did a great job with it. So we're really excited for volume two, which should be coming out very, very early into 2021.
Oh, good. Well, please be sure I find out about it, because you're coming back on. And I'd like to have him on, too, if he wants to do it. We'd have fun. Anyway, also, it's another excuse to get my brother to come on, who isn't. He's a Bigfoot expert and a cryptid expert and a very brilliant guy. And I've been trying to get him to come on the show. He's afraid I'll tell stories about the practical jokes he's played on me, which have been many. There is some reciprocity, but we won't go into that. In any case, let's go on now. 1988, Oregon. You speak of Bigfoot aboard UFOs. Here is this wonderful sentence. Recurring abductee Katharina Wilson sees captive animals aboard an alien spacecraft, including a large feline and two tall gorilla-like beings, one of which has fallen asleep with a newspaper across its chest. Now,
yeah, I love that sentence.
Yeah. Okay. Now, tell us a little bit more about that story.
Well, you know, Katharina Wilson is someone who has had some recurring experiences in her life. She was a protege of Bud Hopkins. Not a lot of people talk about her. She has a website and a book that came out called The Alien Jigsaw, and she has a lot of different.
I might have interviewed her for The Alien Jigsaw. I know it's an interesting book.
She's had some interesting experiences, and what I really like about the way that she talks about them is that she's really honest about not always being sure whether it's an actual experience or a dream. And, you know, I know that sometimes that is a very clear line, and sometimes it's a very blurry line, but, you know, the honesty to sort of sit with that. And honestly, I don't think it matters if it's an experience or a dream or not, because dreams are experiences. But yeah, that was one of a collection of cases that we have in the book of Bigfoot being seen inside. And I'll have to say that every time I collected a case of Bigfoot seen inside of a UFO, it always had something of a little bit of a goofy aspect to it. But again, you know, I think that's baked into a lot of these experiences. The phenomena certainly seems to have a sense of humor, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I think it also capable of mind control, and I think the phenomenon might have created Chewbacca.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think that
in the mind of the creator. I'm not.
I think that this phenomena is deeply tied into the way that we think about the world and archetypes and whatnot. People tend to get a little bit upset when I bring in Jung into the discussion because they think that I'm saying that it's all in the mind. That's not what I'm saying necessarily. I'm saying that a lot of the stuff is from the mind, but it's not necessarily in the mind. A little bit of a distinction there. There are too many, you know, Tim puts it best in the book. He says, you know, if there are plenty of people in ufology who want to assume that Bigfoot being the proximity of a UFO must be a coincidence. But if Bigfoot is indeed, an undiscovered primate, then why don't we see UFOs checking out orangutans or gorillas? You know, to see a Bigfoot is rare enough, but to see a Bigfoot and then moments later see a UFO, it really does seem to magnify the unlikelihood of seeing those things together at an exponential level. And I think that's something that we really need to consider. And when you look at, you know, the spectrum of things that are attributed to fairies, Bigfoot, some post-abduction phenomena, and, you know, traditionally held, you know, Western European witches, they're all a suite of these phenomena that just really do seem the same. You've got stone throwing, you've got strange odors, you've got knocks and raps heard, you know, both in the forest and in the seance room. And then at the center of a lot of these things is this motif of the hairy wild man that just won't seem to go away.
Well, tell us about the hairy wild man.
You know, it's interesting. While a lot of the behavior that people attribute to Bigfoot, stone throwing and hooting and all these sort of things, even child abduction to a certain degree, are things that have been observed in primate populations, all those things and more that are observed in these Bigfoot sightings are absolutely hallmarks of the wild man archetype. With an emphasis on Western Europe, but also really worldwide. You have certain ogres and ogresses that a lot of cryptozoologists will acknowledge are, you know, one-to-one analogs for Bigfoot in, say, the Pacific Northwest. But then there's this interesting bit that they happen to live at the bottom of the sea or something, which is not something you'd expect from a primate, but actually has an extreme close association with the wild men of European folklore that would sometimes live at the bottom of lakes or live in the lake sometimes. You know, the wild men archetype that we would think about lives on the edge of civilization. It's a size shifter. It's a shape shifter. And there are reports of size and shape shifting Bigfoot, believe it or not, folks. Closely associated with demons. And when it was a wild woman, oftentimes associated with witches, which is something that I just had never even put together that there might be a remote correlation between Bigfoot sightings and Western European folklore on witches. But you've got, you know, the bulletproof connection, which you'll find in certain witchcraft testimonies, witch trials, where they would literally, in one case, they were trying to cut the witch's hair and supposedly the scissors would break because the witch's body was impervious. But also Bigfoot appearing in episodes of sleep paralysis as a bedroom invader, which is something that you would definitely associate with witchcraft and the old hag syndrome. And things like the braiding of hair, which was something that, the braiding of horses' manes, which was something that was long attributed to witches and fairies in Europe. And now in the New World, in 2020, we see horses with their hair braided, and, you know, we attribute it to Bigfoot in some circles. So I really think it's interesting how this body of phenomena that is objective and real gets constantly reappropriated to a new sort of boogeyman. And I think that the phenomena is real, and I think that there's something genuinely anomalous and strange about it, but it's interesting how we keep on shifting out the culprit every time we switch civilizations or go through the years.
Well, in the chapter Witches, it's a fascinating chapter, by the way, and, you know, as my listeners know, I am not against Wicca. Wiccans often get on the show, and we talk about it as a positive a positive phenomenon. So, but this is a different approach. This is more of the folkloric approach to witches. In August of 1978, Bigfoot encounters racked the small town of Minerva, Ohio. Dare we go on? What happened there?
Absolutely. It's a fascinating case because it really does illustrate one of these commonalities that you'll see in a lot of these Bigfoot cases that also have resonances through folklore. The Caton family of Minerva, Ohio, had a lot of different sightings. Sometimes they would see this silhouette, this big hairy silhouette on the ridge behind their house, and they'd have stones thrown at them, and they'd pick up the stones, and the stones would be warm to the touch, and they'd, mark the stones with an X and throw it back, and the stone would get thrown back to them. Warm to the touch, a cryptozoologist would say, well, the Bigfoot has it in his hand, but also those stones that are warm to the touch are something that you find in all sorts of showers of stones and poltergeist cases and whatnot. So I find that interesting, but also some of the witnesses during the Minerva Monster Flap literally referred to the monster itself as a big hairy witch. And to make matters even more confusing, sometimes this, big hairy witch, this Bigfoot, this Sasquatch, would be seen flanked by two large, odd-looking felines, sort of like a cougar or a puma. And, again, it's just odd that that would happen, but when you consider the breadth of folklore that identify witches' familiars as being cats or even large anomalous cats, it really does bring into question if we're dealing with sort of a new sort of recontextualization of the phenomena. And to clarify, as you did just before you asked me that, we're not talking about, magical practitioners or, people who practice Wicca. I want to make that abundantly clear. I spoke with my friend Gordon White about this, and I said, do you think this is, really offensive anyway? And he said, no, there are witches, and there's also like that sort of witch archetype, which is usually used to describe, the other, the sort of antagonistic form that a lot of this phenomena sometimes take. So just to be clear to all my Wiccan friends out there.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm hoping that my Wiccan friends will not be dragged away by Bigfoot. But in any case, the thing is that there's this hairy monster kind of meme everywhere. As you point out, in two movies, both Eyes of Fire and The Blair Witch Project, witches were covered with hair. I remember when Ann and I went to see the Blair Witch Project in 1999, just at the scariest moment, lightning struck the movie theater.
What?
The whole place blew up. The screen shattered and everything. People were brain bent by it. We all had to end up standing out in the rain in the lobby in the outside of the building, but they got it fixed and we got to see the end of the movie. Anyway, this connection is fascinating because, you mentioned the Quaquiddle Wild Woman, and which is a Bigfoot analog. And is it that people are mistaking Bigfoot, or are these more human-looking beings that are like Bigfoot but closer to us?
That's a really good question, and you're right. The sort of, for lack of a better term, the meme of the hairy creature appears in all sorts of stuff. A lot of times fairies were conceived as, short little hairy brownies or hairy trolls, which are basically like Bigfoot. Sometimes little hairy monsters were also witches' familiars. As far as whether we're looking at, that's sort of the million-dollar question in a lot of circles. If you've already bought into the existence of Bigfoot, are we looking at a human-like ape or an ape-like human? I'm not really sure. I kind of think that perhaps it's something literally splitting the difference in between. But there is a long history, a long folkloric tradition of people who become feralized after leaving to go into the wilderness. And there was almost a belief at some point that if you spent enough time in the wilderness, you would become more animalistic and you know, just by merit of living out in the woods, turn into a wild man in terms of growing more hair and whatnot. I don't think that that's the case, but at the same time, it really is interesting to look at how we have treated these stories of wild men over the years. If you look at sort of, especially in America, stuff from newspaper articles from the 18th century or 19th century, late 18th, early 19th century, they tend to describe these as being sort of hairy men, but they always have some vestiges of being civilized. They are carrying an old rusty farming implement or a broken musket, or they're using fire and cooking food over a pot. And if you look at sort of the older traditions of wild men, oftentimes in cultures around the world, they were viewed as completely articulate, civilized, very magically operant beings that had mastery over the forest. And then if you look at that again, in the modern day, you see that Bigfoot has completely been primitivized, almost as this big dumb ape. So you have this spectrum going over the years from very sophisticated in the medieval literature to sort of being half sophisticated, half, you know, half ape-like. And then now today, it's all completely ape-like. And it's almost an inverse of what you've seen with the UFO phenomena, which started out, you know, in terms of thinking about the airship wave. I know that the sightings go way beyond that by thousands of years, but if we're just going to sort of look at the American experience, you've got the airship wave with these steampunk airships that move into these Art Deco flying saucers, that move into sophisticated black stealth triangles and now plasmoids floating through the air. It's almost like the UFO phenomena has gone from less sophisticated to more sophisticated. And the Bigfoot phenomena, as we've mapped every inch of the world, has gone from more sophisticated to less sophisticated as we assume a sort of superiority over nature and the element.
Yeah, you know, the steampunk aspect of that aerial phenomenon has always fascinated me. One of those things showed up over my great-grandmother's house, apparently, in San Antonio. Yeah. One researcher told me that it had been over this particular street corner, and I thought, my goodness, that's where my great-grandmother, she lived on that street corner, but there was never any word about it in the family. So,
But of course it happened there by your grandmother.
That's what I thought, of course. Yeah. Where else?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't mean that dismissively. I mean that as, you know, a matter of course, given all, everything that you've had happen.
So anyway, where are we now? We have this world that we live in, and we've talked now over the past few minutes about a number of things that aren't supposed to be there, and that we don't know actually where there is. Are they coming in from another reality, or are they capable of passing back and forth between this reality, which is their home, and other realities? Can we tell the difference? Is there any evidence that suggests either way?
Or, you know, I would venture further to say different times, which might effectively be different realities as well. I really don't know if there is a way to tell, other than the fact that I would put betting money on the fact that we won't have answers. And that's not me being defeatist. I think that we talked about this a little bit last time. I was talking about how, you know, everyone needs to have their own personal UFO disclosure. Like, that's where disclosure truly happens. And I think the same thing is sort of needs to happen with the Bigfoot question as well. I think that what is really interesting is that the discussion and the dialogue surrounding all these topics has opened up in big ways. I know that Mike Cleland has talked for a long time about how once you get the ufologists to the bar after all the presentations have been given at the conference, that's when you can actually get them to open up about synchronicities and about all the strange things. And that's something that Timothy and I have noticed with Bigfoot researchers as well, and that you started to hear, is that once you get them to let their hair down, so to speak, they start saying, yeah, there was, you know, I was in the middle of the wilderness and I heard a car door slam. And, you know, I'm 40 miles from any road and I heard a car door slam, you know, at the same time that I was having Bigfoot activity, or people seeing, you know, this light phenomena. There is a strong tradition of light and plasma phenomena that happen at sites of Bigfoot habituation that doesn't really get talked about, but kind of everybody knows. It's like the worst kept secret amongst Bigfoot.
Yeah, well, you talk about the orange plasmas a lot in your book.
Oh, absolutely.
And triangular UFOs. That there's a couple of cases of triangular UFOs being mentioned.
Yep. There's an example that I really like from the book of Kirk Stroud, Survivor Man. I believe it was Kirk Stroud. I don't know why I'm blanking on his name. Can we take that out? Because it's not his name at all. If you don't mind putting a pin in this moment, Willie. Les Stroud, sorry. Yeah, so there is a moment in the book where we talk about Les Stroud, the Survivor Man of television, who is camping, I believe, in somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, in Washington. And he is sort of fading in and out of sleep, and he sees over off this mountain ridge, he sees this gigantic, triangular UFO, and he's got to be the size of like a mall, like or a mall parking lot, just absolutely gigantic. And later that night, he has what feels like this intense sleep paralysis that's on his chest, and because of the way that he's positioned, he can't really see what's on his chest. He has the impression of these two heavy, large buttocks sitting on his chest in sort of a playful manner. He wasn't too alarmed, but he had specifically gone to this area to look for Bigfoot. And he had had some bait in a tree, some things that were high up enough that, a bear couldn't just come up and reach it, but, perhaps a Bigfoot that's 8 feet tall could. And he had a game can aimed at the site. And the next morning he saw that in the course of two different photos on the video, I believe it was video, the food, the bait is in the tree. In one frame, and then the next frame completely gone. But just in between, there seems to be this conical ape-like head that sort of gets interspliced in between those two moments. So you have, a UFO, you have this sort of sleep paralysis variant, and you have something that is not only tall enough and apparently ape-like, taking something out of the tree, but also somehow has the ability to manipulate the equipment that's being used to monitor it. So it really sits at this strange center of just oddness. That, you're no stranger to, certainly.
Oddness, yes. And here is, Free Dreamlanders, some real oddness, but it's fun oddness. You should do something about it. We'll be right back.
When Plato's ancestor Solon received the story of Atlantis from this Egyptian priest, the Egyptian priest said to him, "Many and manifold are the destructions of mankind. You know of but one. But you Greeks are like children. There are many, many destructions of mankind by all various types of means."
That's an excerpt from a show with Rand Flemath, who wrote the original book about crustal shift that is based on the theories of Charles Hapgood. There are three Dreamlands with Rand over the years. That one's from 2015. He goes all the way back to 2004. And they are totally relevant and totally fascinating right now. All you have to do to locate those shows is go to our search engine on unknowncountry.com and input the words Flemath, FLEM-ATH. His last name, and all of the shows will pop up. And then if you want to listen to these incredible programs, literally available nowhere else on earth, as far as I know, you can subscribe to unknowncountry.com for $4.95 a month or $39.50 a year. And when you do, you get a literal wealth of enjoyment from this website, including the full length Dreamland every week, every new Dreamland that comes up. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to the site and click on the subscribe tab. Get started. Now subscribers can also listen through any app that accepts subscription-based podcasts. One that we use is the Castro app, and it works great. You can have Dreamland pushed to your app every week. Subscriber now, just as you can, as a free Dreamlander.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
How curious are you? How much do you really want to know about the world you live in? There are, for example, very real conspiracies. We're talking about one of them today. And this is a place where if it's real, we're going to talk about it, but not if it's not real. So there's no confusion here. If we're talking conspiracy on Dreamland and on unknowncountry.com, it's because we can prove it, just like we can prove that the Roswell incident has been covered up. We can prove these things. We can prove that the abduction phenomena is in some way very real. We can prove that there are unusual materials in this world because some of them are right here in my possession. So, this is an unusual place. It's a unique place. And above all, it is a great place to explore. Exploring the unknowncountry.com archive is a really extraordinary experience. It's a place where you can regain what we are losing, which is a lost sense of wonder and a willingness and to explore the unknown. We live in a terribly difficult world right now. This place is an oasis of wonder. Join unknowncountry.com today. We're talking to Joshua Cutchin. His book, Where the Footprints End, written with his co-author Timothy Renner, Volume 1, Folklore. We're exploring the folklore that surrounds and interpenetrates the whole Bigfoot phenomenon and mixes it all up with the alien phenomena and the fairy lore. His website is joshuacutchin.com, and you can click through to joshuacutchin.com or on the Dreamland page. Okay, now, here's another thing that happens. And this, we made brief reference earlier to the Skinwalker Ranch. And what happened, folks, those of you who don't know, the scientists arrived at the ranch, and just as the family who had been sitting around waiting for them to come to turn over the ranch to them, that had been bought by Bob Bigelow, these scientists drove up, and the family was in a great state of excitement because a wolf had jumped into a goat paddock. A huge wolf, and as Joshua said earlier in the show, a dire wolf. This is a Pleistocene animal from the Ice Age, and had been bothering the goats in the paddock, and they had been firing, the family had been firing rifles at it, and it had hardly noticed the bullets, but finally had jumped out of the paddock and run back into the swamp, or a wetland that was nearby. When the scientists went down to the wetland, they found footprints that just stopped. They were able to take plaster casts of these footprints, and they found that they were the prints of a 300-pound animal. But here's the thing. They just stopped. And in this book, Joshua talks a lot about these animals, the Bigfoot, just their prints just simply stopping in the middle of, in the middle of a place where they can make prints. It just stops. And, you know, as you know, my listeners know this, I've been back and forth a couple times at this point in my life between parallel universes because I'm trying to do it. I know it's real and I'm trying to do it. How is it that they can do it? Because I'm not asking you if they can do it, because we know they can do it, at least I do. But what do you think is the mechanism? Do you have any idea?
Mechanism for, I mean...
For being able to pass between the universes.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I can really certainly say Well, the only thing that I can say that I suspect with any degree of conviction, I suppose is a little bit more appropriate, is that it must somehow be consciousness-based. I mean, that's what I keep on coming back to throughout all the research that I've done, is that consciousness is really absolutely key to a lot of these phenomena. And, you know, I mean, you talk to people who are able to slip into trance states and meditation states very easily, to say nothing of, you know, people who slip into window areas of, you know, time slips and things like that. So if you take that, this sort of stories on their face value, then imagine having the ability to, you know, to produce that on demand. Perhaps if this is a flesh and blood creature, which is still, you know, an option that we should entertain, perhaps something evolutionary has, given them the ability to slip into those spaces on demand. I mean, you know, maybe Bigfoot is what happens when you have human beings who are subjected to the contact experience for long enough, and that evolutionary pressure is put on them that stridently. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, you just have to wonder. And, you know, I'd like to be able to, I know the other universe is there because I know how to see it now. I can actually see it, and it's no secret. I can tell you how I do it. It takes bright sunlight. But if I go into a place that is bright sunlight, not too crowded, and somewhere where I can sit and close my eyes, after a few seconds, a whole different world appears that I can see. It's absolutely amazing. And not only that, it brings with it a sense of longing and homesickness. But I can't go there. I can only see it. Okay.
You know what's interesting about that description, if I might interject quickly, as I was just doing some research for another project, and, you know, normally associate these things happening at sort of liminal times of dusk and dawn and whatnot, but there was also a line of thought that you were most able to see the fairy folk if you were to try to see them at midday in bright sunlight. So that's really interesting that you bring that up.
Yeah, I did not know that. The biggest physical encounters I've had have been at two times. One is in what is known as the Brahma-Muhurta time, the time of interchange, which is a couple hours before sunrise. That's when the first communion experience happened. And the other is in that liminal time, just at sunrise, when I had a very powerful close encounter that I couldn't quite complete. I was invited to go down and be with them, and I didn't do it. I'm actually glad I didn't now, because I have a feeling I might not have come back. I might be living with them now. Because, you know, you can live with them for 20 minutes, apparently, and end up coming back 45 years later.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Why do you think that is? And is that, I didn't see that anywhere in the book, any reference to times. You made a brief reference to time slips a few minutes ago, but I didn't see any, maybe I missed it, but I didn't see any reference to time distortion in connection.
There are actually, to my surprise, a couple of stories that I was able to find that described Bigfoot and instances of missing time. One of my favorite examples was the host of a very popular podcast. He was Sasquatch Chronicles. His name is Wes Germer. He and his brother had an incident that was a very harrowing encounter where they were sort of trapped in their car on the top of a mountain. And they could have sworn that the entire incident should have only taken about 40 minutes because they had gone up there. They ended up parking and sort of gotten boxed in by these creatures. Could have sworn it should have only taken 40 minutes, and it actually took about 4 hours. Memory serves. And one of the co-hosts, who was, you know, very much of a flesh and blood cryptozoologist type, said, "Oh, well, time passes faster when you're under duress." And that's literally the opposite of what every laboratory experiment about time perception has shown. When you're in stressful situations, time tends to slow, not speed up. So that's just one example. There are a couple other examples where I know that there was a witness who was sitting in a deer stand. I can't recall where off the top of my head, but he was sitting in a deer stand, and he had a Bigfoot touch his foot and then saunter off into the forest. And it took the gentleman about 2.5 hours, I think, to go the half mile back to his car over even terrain. And he doesn't really have a good sense of why that is. So As far as what that mechanism is, you know, I am not really sure. Suffice to say that it's something that you see in the contact experience, and you certainly see it in fairy lore, not just of the, you know, British variety, but also in the New World, you'll find little people who, if you were to visit their realms, would put you in a sense of time dilation as well. And surprisingly enough, happens in Bigfoot encounters too.
I've had missing time experiences. A lot of close encounter witnesses do. I had a big one a few years ago in LAX, the airport. My listeners know about it. I was I disappeared from reality for 45 minutes. And what is the relationship between the experiences we've been talking about and missing time? And I know it's sort of related to time dilation, but it's different because time doesn't change. You do. You just are gone for a while.
Right. And, you know, I think that this is something that I'm working on right now, but, you know, it's so persistent across, again, obviously the alien contact experience and fairy lore of both Old and New World, and also, you know, as we just sort of illustrated, the Bigfoot stuff. I feel like I've heard it similarly described in ghost folklore, but it's also described amongst people who enter altered states of consciousness, be it induced by meditation or by, you know, psychedelic drugs. And I think that it has something to do with the altered state that one enters when they are in contact with this other world. Beyond that, I can't really quite articulate where my feelings are right now, but I think it has something to do with that.
Now, there are many stories in the folklore of the world of essentially Bigfoot, big hairy creatures, who will collect, for example, Baba Yaga collects babies, children, in her sack, for and others, the Kwakutl Doskonya and the Lumi Cheeni, both Bigfoot variants, toss children into baskets for later consumption. Now, there is a guy our listeners know very well, David Pilates, who researches disappearances in the woods. Are we talking about something that happens in the woods, do you think?
Possibly. You know, I will say that, you know, I really like to tease out the implications of saying that one thing is related to another. So, if, you know, fairies are associated with the dead, as they are in a lot of different cultures, and obviously the visitors are associated with the dead as well, from your experience, then where does that leave us when we take a look at the fact that both of these things have, you know, these tangential links to Sasquatch as well? Does that mean that Sasquatch is associated with the dead? And I think that a lot of the missing 411 phenomena really does line up quite parsimoniously with a lot of these warnings that you find about avoiding abduction by fairy folk in Western Europe.
Yes.
Having said that, it's very much a hallmark of these North American wild men, these Bigfoot analogs, to abduct children quite commonly. And interestingly enough, if you take a look at some of the wild man traditions of Europe, there are literally hairy wild men who engage in behavior that can be accurately described as changeling swapping, which, you know, is the idea that you supplant a child of, you know, a fairy child for a human child in exchange. You'll find that with wild men as well. So it all definitely seems to be part of a suite of the similar phenomena. One of the things that I find really interesting about a lot of the missing 411 phenomena is the manner in which search efforts are often stymied by foul weather. And, you know, traditionally, any passage to the other world was often marked by a large storm, thematically, not only in literature, but also in legend, myth, and oral traditions as well. Be it, you know, a fog, be it a blizzard, be it a thunderstorm, something, some sort of weather phenomena, very strong weather phenomena, you know, a thick fog or a violent storm, would oftentimes mark that passage to the other world. So you have to wonder if we're not seeing people sort of slipping into this other reality, this other realm, this other dimension, as we've been talking about, in a lot of these cases, and whether or not that particular journey is being facilitated by something like Bigfoot is an entirely valid question.
Yeah, exactly. And we're just not really at the, you know, we don't really have an ability to understand what that is, except to say that we live in a very strange world. And the farther you get from home base, from the city, the stranger it gets. The forests are filled with magic. And this is something that troubles me a lot, because the greatest magical forest in the world is in the Amazon, and it is being intentionally burned down. And in California and Siberia, huge forests are burning down. Sequoias, hundreds of years old, are just burning down. What does that mean to all of this, do you think?
Well, it's an absolute tragedy. And especially when you consider, you know, one of the most elegant things that I've ever read about the forest was penned by a former Sorbonne medieval historian, Claude Lecouteux, who once described the forest as a conservatory of paganism. And I think that, you know, as much as I lament the fact that Notre Dame caught on fire, it's just as heartbreaking for me to see these large swaths of land do the same. It's interesting that you bring that up, because just as sort of the alien gray had its moment, its cultural touchstone moment in the 1990s, I think, that was a real high watermark for the phenomenon, its depictions in media and whatnot. I think Bigfoot is having a similar moment here in the past 4 or 5 years and up through what's happening currently. You know, the number of times I go out and I see a Bigfoot bumper sticker or someone wearing a Bigfoot t-shirt or something, Bigfoot is very popular. And I kind of wonder if that imagery and that popularity isn't spurred on by the fact that we are in the midst of such a crisis. I mean, I wonder if it's almost, if you take a look at Bigfoot as being almost like a tutelary spirit or a guardian of the forest, if there isn't a message there that's trying to get us to return and to refocus our attention back on the natural world, because we're so distracted nowadays. I mean, I know that's sort
of... No, you're not kidding. With the pandemic and all the political upheavals in the United States and elsewhere, we're failing to notice what is happening kind of behind our backs. It's scary. Well, listen, Joshua, we have not come to the end of our time together, but somebody has come to the end of their time with us. The Free Dreamlanders must now pack their bags and go home, because their time with us is ending. We have in the final half hour with Joshua, we're going to be talking about the Colbran, a controversial collection of 11 books, 6 Egyptian and 5 Celtic, that have some very surprising stuff to do with all of this. And then we're going to spend a final half hour in the special 2-hour edition of Dreamland talking to Maria Sagi about remote healing and the Akashic Records. Absolutely fascinating interview. So, Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much, as always, for being with us. And why don't you take the plunge? It's fun. We're talking to Joshua Cutchin, his new book, Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness and the Bigfoot Phenomenon, his website, joshuacutchin.com. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for spending time with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.